I'll talk, though. You're all here because of the enlightenment of the Buddha. And that's what allowed the conditions that kind of gave us a teaching that's really simple and straightforward, really, when you break down the Buddhist teaching. But incredibly deep, because what it's giving you is a very good description of reality. And when we practice that, when you practice here, what you're trying to do is kind of finding the stillness, the mindfulness, the reverence, and then trying to bring that into your daily life, because that's, you can't attach to the forms, but you can actually attach to the teaching that underlies the forms. You know, that's why you meditate here, so you can bring more of that attitude into your life and change your life. Because really, everything we're doing is how can we, the whole goal of practice is how do we relate to everything as a Buddha? You know, how do we relate to everything with reverence, with gratitude, with, you know, and not cut our lives, the world, into pieces? And, you know, and that's why we meditate, so we can change our attitude. We can actually change some of these habitual, what's flowing through our minds and moving us. There's all these patterns of thought, of fantasy, of desire, of fear, ways of seeing the world that if we hold on to, we'll stay in this deluded state in which there's a lot of suffering. And that's why one of the reasons we're practicing is to cultivate mindfulness of seeing what is it that we're doing. You know, unless you actually take responsibility for what you're thinking and acting, how's that ever anything going to work? It'd be like saying, I'm going to build a house, but I don't want to pay attention. You know, and in fact, if you build a house, the first thing you pay attention to is the foundation. And actually, when you're doing construction, you don't get that right, nothing else is going to work. And that's what right view does. It sets, and you're coming here for, is to get a foundation so that the structure of your life can be built upon reality rather than things that are going to just blow away in the wind. And the Buddha called mindfulness the flood stopper. It stops the flood of greed, of all our desires, the flood of hatred and all our ill will, and a flood of delusion and ignorance. And if we're not careful, that's what's, we're being flooded with it. You know, people get upset and it's just like, why are they angry? Well, they want it this way and not that way. That's all. But without mindfulness, you're kind of, God, these people are awful. This is awful. That's awful. I'm awful. And you're never going to find the truth and free yourself if everything's awful. Or you're not going to free yourself if everything is so wonderful and magical. I was watching something not long ago on TV of a kind of a classic thing where somebody meets somebody and they get married like almost immediately and then find out that they have nothing, you know, this is never going to work. And, you know, and of course that's just getting caught up in, you know, basically being intoxicated by our desire and projecting it out. So this is going to make my life complete. And then realizing I don't even know what's going to, this being who I think is going to do that for me. And with mindfulness, we're learning to relate to what conditions, both external in the world and internal in ourselves, when they arise, what do we do with them? The way our mind is conditioned without mindfulness, without meditation, without paying attention, is it's used to being trapped. It actually purposely finds boxes to go into. you know, wow, I'm caught up with this dream. I'm caught up with this fear. I'm caught up with what just happened to me yesterday. I'm caught up with my childhood. I'm caught up with this feeling. I'm caught up with this. And just think of it, how you can just be trapped in a box. You know, like, I'm trapped in this body. I'm trapped in this state of mind. I'm trapped in this. And it's not like it's not happening, but nothing's binding you. It's just sensation, thought, conditions that are going through. And that's why, and strong feelings arise, strong conditions arise, and without training, they just sweep you away. And you're not aware that you have a choice. You know, think of it, when you're angry, you're not being mindful that you're choosing it. You're just angry. You know, desire arises and you don't even notice, wow, I have a choice here. You just go with it. You know, it's almost like that donut that somehow went from the table into my mouth without any thought. And actually, we've all probably eaten that way if you think about it. You know, suddenly, I didn't even remember choosing. But we do that with much more than donuts. Where training would be really easy. I just solve donuts and I'm free. And I think I've done that. I haven't had a donut in the longest time. And the mindfulness and the awareness means we can actually see with mindfulness what our choices are leading to, thus the precepts. What is causing good? What's causing bad? If we're not aware of that, what are we, if we're not aware of the consequence, which is the consequences of our choices, and if we're not paying attention to the consequences of our choices, it's almost like, it would, again, it would be like building something, and I don't care. You know, I don't care if this is going to work. This piece doesn't have to fit. I just want to get it up. And then you step back and you go, oh, God, what did I just do? And that's actually what a lot of our lives are. We step back and, like, what have I done? You know, what have I built here? You know, and that's why if with mindfulness you can just see what's good to do without making a big deal out of it. You can actually take the drama, the clutching out of what's going on, which again, with mindfulness, if you're not careful, suddenly, without mindfulness, you're making a drama out of everything. You know, if you're not careful, your life can be this Shakespearean play. You know, with tragedy, with triumph, with all this stuff, rather than just saying what is good and what isn't. And quietly doing it, almost the way, you know, you just help without making a thing out of helping. And without mindfulness, without really applying the Buddhist teaching, what we do is we just so strongly identify with what's happening to us. With our feelings, with our memories, with our thoughts, that we build up guilt, shame, pride, and make these edifices out of it. And we don't even know we're doing it. It just seems automatic. Well, I'm a mess. I did this wrong. I am this way. I am that way. And we're building kind of a really not very good, it's like building a really bad wall. You know, and you can even see it in meditation. You can see how you can get caught up with just how you're meditating. God, I can't stand my mind going all over the place. I don't like this. What's going on? Rather than just, okay, there's just a feeling coming up. Don't identify with it. It's just a feeling. Come back, just be there. Nothing. The nice thing about meditation is nothing's going on. You know, I mean, nothing's going on. I'm looking at a wall. You know, just let go and just see that we're producing all this stuff, all this flow, all this thing, and just come back. Don't think about good meditation, bad meditation. Just come back. Just be there and let go of what's happening. It. Because we can get both in meditation and in life identify with what we do well, with pride, and or identify with what we're failing with guilt and aversion. Like, I'm kind of such of this. And what we're trying to do is be content with and trust that it's okay the way things are right now. We just have to relate to it better. The problem isn't in the conditions. The problem is the grasping and the pushing away. You know, which changes, starts changing our relationship to do it. Because wisdom arises instead of demanding or requiring. Wisdom will only arise out of a mind and heart that is content, that trusts, that is willing just to see what's there with kind of a solid feeling. And then when the door to our heart opens and things become clear and liberating, because we realize none of this is binding us. For instance, if you have pride, you're going to be bound by the fact that at times the pride can't cover up the fact that you don't do something well. You know. You know, and then I have to understand training as not what's happening to us, but how we relate to what's happening to us. It's all in the right relationship. And no matter what we do, there's something to relate to. You're sitting there in meditation. What's happening? You're by yourself in the woods. What's happening? You're at work. What's happening? You're reading the newspaper. What's happening? You're in an intense situation. What's happening? You're in having a meal out, you know, a potluck shortly. What's happening? And it involves just the willingness to be where you are and kind of not grasp after it, not push it away, just see what is good to do here, what's really happening here, and trusting that on a deeper level, nothing's really happening. You know, it's just stuff, conditions flowing through us. You know, and we can see how we distort all this. Like, just think of relationships. Most of the problem in relationships comes because I want the person to be this way. If you stop doing that, there's very rarely a problem in a relationship. And you know, what we're trying to do is realize our training is that we're not latching onto a particular feeling, particular mood, a particular situation even. We're trying to relate to everything with a sense of openness, of not making it a drama, not making it a big deal, and a sense of with less demands. You know, just like if you're with somebody, the less demands you have of the way they should be, I can almost guarantee the better your relationship will be. You know, it doesn't mean that you can never ask for anything or do anything, but there's a difference between pointing something out and demanding. You know, just like people have pointed out plenty of things to me, and frequently I thought, oh, that's true. It was, shouldn't be doing that. But if they demand it, it's not very good. Like, you shouldn't be this way. Rather than, well, I'm finding it hard that you're... Like, you know. And part of it is seeing... You know, rather than... And part of it is seeing through the eyes of one of the most useful Buddhist teachings, seeing everything in terms of changeableness, anicca, seeing everything in terms of dukkha, that they're not satisfactory. You can't make them be this complete, wonderful thing, because whatever it is, it won't stay that way. There's something unsatisfactory about everything. You know, in the sense that it won't completely work. If it does for a while, it won't stay that way. Just like you can't keep eating. People have tried, it doesn't work. You know, you can't keep staying on vacation. You can't keep anything going. You can't keep being a success. You know, everything burns out. Everything changes. Changeableness, anicca, and anatta, no self, not making anything yours. Trying not to possess what happens to you. Because when you start seeing things through anicca, through change, things start being less compulsive, less dramatic, less important. You know? It's just like somebody was having a child trouble with their, you know, 3-year-old not long ago. And I said, don't worry, they'll be off to college soon. You know, which actually is, you know, before you know it, they will be off to college. And it's like, okay, you know, now I don't know what they're doing, so. You know, and it's, you know, it's, but dukkha doesn't mean that everything is miserable and wretched or suffering. It's more a sense of incompleteness, you know, of dissatisfaction, you know, with things. You know, it comes out of our usual desire to have things consistent, ordered, the way we want them to be. You know, just think of human relationships. Can you really have a completely satisfactory relationship? Well, if you're really close to somebody, no. I've never been around anybody who doesn't annoy me at times. In fact, when I was younger, I used to do an interesting thing is travel with somebody where you're with them all in a way you're not usually with somebody. When you're traveling, you're with them all the time. You're eating with them, and I found it didn't matter how much I liked the person, they drove me crazy after, you know. I just find them irritating after a while. And they were often, you know, my best friends. I mean, but just the nature of things is that it's very hard. You know, and there's a natural thing that things are unsatisfactory because they keep changing, they keep breaking down, they keep not being the way that we want. There's discomfort, there's pain in life. The world is unresolved. Often we don't know what to do. That doesn't feel very satisfactory. It's like most people really would like to know what to do. They would like to know what's going on. If you actually do know what to do all the time and you knew what know what's going on, it just points out that you're really deluded. Because you only know what's going on some of the time. If you always know what a good choice is, it means you don't really look at things very carefully. Because when you really look at things carefully, you often don't always know what to do. You don't know how things are going to resolve. You don't even know what's going on often. I mean, sometimes I talk to somebody, I don't have a clue what's going on. you know, with somebody, you know, and I've even had it where I've run somebody past a whole bunch of different monks because nobody can get a clue what's going on with this person. And truthfully, it's, you know, it's, some people it's very hard to get a good grasp what's going on with them. You know, how can we help them? You know. However, the training isn't that we have to get things right, but we get our intention to try to do what's good. And that allows us to be at peace with what it is, because that's all we can do. You know, it's not like I worry if I don't get something right. I just go, well, I try, you know, I just look, try to get my intention right. And the rest is what it is. So that's all I can do. And I accept that limit. And I don't get upset, you know, that, you know, I don't try to take it deeply to heart when something, I get something where it didn't work or, you know, like I gave bad advice. You know, if I want to give good advice, I have to be willing to give bad advice. There's no other way because I can't always know what is the good advice. If I want to help people, that means occasionally I'm going to hurt somebody. You know, and there's no way around it because at times you just don't see what's going on. And hopefully, if you're being mindful, you can learn from it and over time be more skillful. But it doesn't mean you're ever, nobody I know is always, you know, skillful. You know, it's, and that's where the training of the Buddha so much is really tested, when we come up into those situations that frustrate us, that we feel are really unsatisfactory, and that we have a habitual response of anger, of fear. And we can use the Dharma to meet and come out of this. And the way we do it is apply the paramitas, the virtues of Buddhism, of using patience, compassion, equanimity, you know, as tools, as ways to approach it. So instead of thinking, wow, this is the way things should be, okay, how do I practice patience here? Rather than thinking, how do I get them to be the way I want them to be? Which, if you can, it's not wrong, but often, you know, I found in relationships, I haven't figured out that way of getting people to be the way I want them to be. You know, I haven't had great success with that approach. However, patience I can, you know, and compassion, you know, I can try to have. Because the arising of dukkha, the arising of the unsatisfactory nature, isn't a cause for despair like it is in the world, but a pointer of what we need to let go of. Because life is going to keep flowing with forces we can't control. Hell, I can't control what my body's going to do. I could have a malignancy right now. And people go like, cancer is something outside us. Cancer is us. It's our own cells. You know, cancer is me. Growing out of control in me. You know, it's not this. And we don't control that. But we can control the great faith and the great heart that realizes we're not being bound by any of this. You know, that's why the unsatisfactory nature of things is the very ground of what will help us grow our faith. You don't need faith if everything's the way you want it to be. You know, it won't take you great faith probably to eat the potluck. You know. But it'll take faith maybe for you to... Hell, I've had people come for a day retreat and they think, I can't take this anymore. I mean, it's happened a number of times. I've even had people come up to me, you know, who were saying how training's great, wonderful, this is so, you know, just such great stuff, and all you have to do is this and all the rest. And then they did a day retreat and they say, I can't take this anymore.
And you never see them again.
Sometimes I've had it where I didn't see them again. You know, it's like, I don't like this. You know, I'm not supposed to be this uncomfortable. You know, it's like I'm meditating so I can be calm and peaceful and joyful. And instead I'm getting tense and upset. So dukkha is important. The second sign to see the world with is impermanence, inconstancy, uncertainty, anicca. And you can see anicca in the way expectations sets up how you want things to be. If you really think about it, we all have this whole, we keep viewing things on the way we think it to be. We even project this future. This is, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this. And actually, if you look at life, often you never know, you know, what's going to happen. And you know, and the impermanence, and Nietzsche points out to the fact that we can't be certain about anything in the future. Period. You know. There's no certainty about anything. You know, just like time is an abstraction. You know, it's, you know, kind of like the thing that usually makes time in us is just how we're relating to things. If you really want something, time is really different than if you're trying to avoid something. Just like I remember when I was a kid, I did something that some of you are old enough will remember doing, is you used to be able to send off for things off your cereal boxes. And you would send off, and it took months. As a little kid, when you're 9 years old, you'd be kind of asking your mother every day, did it come yet? And for some reason, it took forever. And as a little kid, it seemed like forever. You know, and of course, when you're a child, you know, it's you know, and we make the past into something, we make the future into something, and you know, and it's not like we don't imagine that there won't be a future, but that's just an expectation, you know, what the future is, to let go and just see. You know, the skill you're trying to do in practice is how can you tune into the present and meet things with clarity, with balance. You know, so you meet impermanence by you being solid in your, by sitting still, the solidity's within you, not in the world. That's why somebody who's doing well, you know, meets situations grounded, where this is just, in a way, normal stuff, not a problem. You know, I can remember being around people dying, and what they liked having me around is I just treated it pretty, you know, to me it was normal stuff. And they could actually see that, and that helped them. The fact that, you know, to me it wasn't a big deal. You know, I even remember meeting a funeral director, and he just, and I said, the person body had was in bad shape, and I just said, no, I want to see the face, and was appalled. It's like, face isn't really in good shape. And I said, it's okay. And he opened it up, and yeah, it was true. There's probably no reason to see it, but it didn't upset me, the fact that the face was gone. It was just like, oh well, you know, it's, I seem like if I'm burying somebody, I should see if I can, particularly this was a case of somebody I didn't even know, to look at it. And uncertainty. Another way of looking at Nietzsche is uncertainty. Can you realize if you're certain about something, you're grasping something that's not real? It doesn't mean you can't have a fair degree of awareness that this is probably going to happen. You know, just like, you know, I go in for a minor procedure, you know, I go in for a physical, I'm assuming, you know, with any luck, nothing major is wrong, but something could be wrong. You know? And the third sign is no self, which means not clinging to this identity, to this story, to trying to make you into something or other, which isn't solid. It's impermanent. It's not that real. You know, those all the conditions you identify with aren't solid. Your past, well, if you don't cling to it, what? It's just the past. Right now, if you're sitting here, what of that is controlling you? Why is that you? If you don't cling to it, it's not. Your future, well, we don't have a clue what it's going to be. And part of it is viewing things through me and the other, you know, through the opposites. And if you want to know self, you realize you have to stop looking at everything in terms of this is me, this is mine. I end where my skin ends. This is the end of Kinray. And you know, whenever you experience something as mine, the Dharma is you don't possess anything. Just a temporary condition, like your skin, your hand. My hand goes, I'm still Kinray. You know, I still have something else to identify with when actually I'm not the hand. You know, and whenever there's experience of me, there's an experience that this doesn't have anything to do with me. There's the experience of alienation, of feeling separate, apart, lost, which comes out of clinging to me. Once you cling to me, there's an awful lot that's not you, like everything else. And it doesn't feel that good. I'm this little, you know, it's and part of training is just seeing this stuff and learning that you don't have to cling to it. You're not trying to get away from your thoughts, emotions, memories. You have to develop the right relationship to them, as I started with. How do you relate to them? And not make them into a big deal, but just see them as passing things, and how do I skillfully handle it? Just like you would with somebody else. You know, there's really no difference between your feelings and somebody else's feelings. Just feelings, passing stuff. Somebody else is angry, how do I relate to it? I'm angry, how do I relate to it? When we really train properly, we realize there's no difference. It's just anger. It's just feeling. It's just greed. It's just fear. It's just pride. And when you relate to everything appropriately, that means you're not clinging to the things that you like about yourself, building up this self, and then pushing away all the things you don't like about yourself. I mean, that's what we mostly are doing a lot of the time. Both, God, I'm good at this, I'm that, that. And then pushing away, God, I can't stand this, can't stand that. And then the whole world is that way. You know, you have this whole universe full of that's good stuff, that's bad stuff. You know, and that colors the whole world. We basically color the whole world with our ignorance. You know, with our what we want and what we don't want about ourselves. And then the whole world is that reflection. It's like a mirror. God, I can't believe people are greedy. People are hate. People are this. But we have all those in ourselves. You know, and how do we relate to it? And the trouble, if you don't look at it through no self, you kind of are trapped in this self view, which is very lonely. There's a lack of trust in being this isolated. You know, being an isolated kinrin means a lack of ease, a lack of connection, sense of alienation. And all you have to do is think when you suffer how much you have that feeling. You know, you never suffer without a strong sense of self. Think of it. Get rid of most of that sense of self. Where's the suffering? But it takes a lot of skillful relating to each of those elements to start dissolving that. So why, and I was reading somebody where he was saying, that sense of self makes one of the loneliest places to be is alone in a crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, you're by yourself in the woods, doesn't feel that lonely. You're by yourself in a busy, you know, a place filled with people. It feels very lonely. You know, all these people going by. You know, it's why you can feel much lonelier in a city than in the country. And the whole idea of practice is how do we not be overwhelmed by this, by all this stuff? You know, how do we be with everything, the ups and downs, the flow of conditions, and realize, you know, it's not us. It's just stuff flowing through, like all the feelings, all the thoughts, all the memories, all the desires. Anyway, any comments as I did a lot of talking? As I drink my cold tea.
I'm part of this email network, and I got an email like everyone did in the network. They wanted to know of a mindfulness meditation training group. So I emailed back and I said, check out the Berkeley Buddhist Priory, and gave them the website. And I said, there's meditation 3 times a day. I wrote that email, and this person wrote me back and said, no, I'm looking for a mindfulness meditation group. And I went, well, this is the source. You know, so now there is this people, someone's looking for something with a label that says mindfulness meditation without knowing, that they can come here and meditate. And
as opposed to all the mindless meditation.
We do a lot of that.
I mean, I've done it, but it's... I can tell you it doesn't work well.
That might be a good example of mindless meditation. Well, is that they're looking for this mindful one.
Well, they may want some mind, a place that does just a mindfulness practice, but of course it's like anything else. If you're not careful, labels, even the word meditation can mean different things. You know, how you define a lot of these terms have different meanings. People will come here and say, well, I meditate, and they'll describe what they're doing. And I think, that's kind of stretching the term, or as somebody very nicely wrote in a book where I asked her, she kind of wrote an account of calling up Shasta Abbey and asking about coming to a retreat that wasn't a beginner, so I asked, do you meditate? She said, yes. And then she wrote in the account, if looking out the window counts.
Yeah. I was introduced to a woman by a fellow Buddhist because he said she's interested in finding out more about Buddhism and meditation. And so I met her and I was talking with her and I said, are you currently meditating? And she said, yes. And I say, what do you do? It turns out she spent a half hour every day complaining to God about all the things that she didn't like.
Yeah,
well, that's prayer.
Yeah. That's complaining.
I think complaining is more to prayer than complaining, I think.
Yeah, well, people can, yeah, everyone, words can mean whatever, you know, there are different approaches to things, but, you know, but a lot of training is just coming, you know, it's kind of widening our hearts so we can embrace whatever we encounter without making a problem out of it. You know, like that's the mind of training. And some things are really hard, you know, it's like, you know, but it's funny at times, you know, and we have the expectation, if we do it at this point, why can't we do it at that point? But that's the nature of the way things are, that sometimes a hard condition, you know, let's say pain can be fine, and the next day it could be overwhelming. The same way as you can be with somebody who has a problem, and one day you're fine with them, and the next day they drive you crazy. You know, we keep changing. So our responses as conditions flow keep changing. So we can't have the expectation, oh, we got it. You know, in the sense that whatever it is, it's going to keep changing. And we have to keep coming back to the Dharma and just realizing, okay, how do I apply it here? And applying anicca, anatta, and dukkha are great tools. And actually, in Mahayana, they often add nirvana. You should see change, you should see no self, you should see dukkha, and you should see the fact that everything is the Buddha. Kind of putting a positive spin, the faith that allows us to embrace that with kind of a stillness and a serene center, you know, which opens us to a great heart that can actually embrace all these different conditions. You know, that has, you know, the capacity to have great compassion, you know, feel like connection with everybody, which is what we all want. You know, the opposed to getting trapped in the self. It feels great. Even when somebody's suffering, it feels positive to connect with it. And it feels like a source of suffering not to connect with it. You know, if somebody tells you, God, something awful, and you're just can't leave your own drama, it actually feels uncomfortable. You know, it's like, and we want that great heart that connects. We want the heart that treats everything with kindness. You know, because again, that feels good. You know, there's something very positive. You know, just think of treating something without kindness. Think of doing that for a whole day. Come home, what are you going to feel like? Or be home. What do you feel like? Think of going through a day where you treat everything kindly. All the karmic conditions you encounter. You know, again, you know, one of those things, you know, just like treating things with equanimity. Feels good. You know, there's something very positive about it. Well, going up and down with everything doesn't. We think when we're going up, this is great, but we don't like the flip side, which inevitably happens. You know, just like one of the hard things in practice is treating the things you like with equanimity. We all are willing to try to work at letting go of the things we don't like. but to actually stop getting so caught up in what we like, what brings us joy and pleasure. Not that we have to stop having joy and pleasure, we just have to treat it with equanimity. Almost like the food at the potluck. Equanimity. You know, if you take something, actually it wasn't good. Equanimity. Or, wow, this is the best. You know, these are great. This is great food. You know, you don't have to have, you know, well, equanimity. You know, whatever it is, it's not a big deal. You've eaten many good meals in your life. Where are they all right now? How much happiness did it bring? Or as I used to love it at the Abbey, because it would, he knew it was human, but it would still get to him, is the cook for 20 years, Reverend Master Daishin, would make an elaborate, for special occasions, how do you celebrate as a, you know, just like even here, you know, what's a Buddhist celebration? Eat. You know, have some nice food as a way of celebrating. So we would have a holiday and make a really nice meal that, you know, probably the kitchen spent an extra day, you know, was working on for quite a period of time, and the meal will get over, and usually we'd have often those meals sort of in the middle of the day sometime, you know, 1 o'clock or something like that. And he says that people almost immediately want to know what's for dinner. It's like you're not getting anywhere. You keep feeding them, they keep getting hungry. You know, it's like, I'm just not making any progress. I keep, you know, it's like, no matter how much you cook, they keep being hungry again and again. And of course, when you're doing the job, there gets to be that unrelenting nature of it does have its tiring aspect that no matter what you do, a few hours later, you have to do it again.
Excuse me, Reverend Master Kinray, are you going to have like a talk about Jukai?
Wasn't scheduling one. I mean, not immediately.
Yeah.
I don't, every so often I'll talk about, but unless, you know, and usually if people are going to take the precepts, I'll do some talks with, you know, I can offer some teaching, and I've done talks on all the Jukai topics, but, you know, I haven't done a, you know, I haven't done a specific thing on that in a while. It's like most things, you know. You know, well, I've been here long enough, I've given talks on everything multiple times, so, you know, it's like, I even think I haven't done them in a while. You know, I did lectures on all the scriptures and everything else, and it's just like I haven't done that in a long time, so you probably haven't even heard those talks, because people keep changing. I think that's point something out there. That's the song that keeps. Yeah, Paula?
I like what you said about illness and cancer, that it's us. It's not something external. It's like Parkinson's are us.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this newspaper, The Onion, the satirical newspaper. They were making fun of this because when I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, everything I'd ever heard was, you must fight an illness. You have to knock it to the ground, fight. You know, I don't like to see it in terms of fighting anything. It's like you're coexisting and you're doing the best you can for yourself.
Oh, yeah.
But you're not trying to beat anything up. It's a part of you now. So The Onion said, you know, how usually the newspapers report on somebody who's been a brave soldier and is fighting cancer. And they said, cowardly local man says, I'm a dead man. So that's always stuck with me.
I often kind of say, you know, when we're battling disease, it's like, you know, it's me fighting me.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing what we can and putting up with, hopefully with equanimity and patience to the best of our ability. And often at times not, because that's the nature. If we could, the nature of practice is, you know, just like I was talking to somebody who recently in tremendous pain, and they were saying how for a while I could take the pain, and now it's getting overwhelming, and it's just like, okay, that's normal enough. You know, it's like, wow, if nothing overwhelmed us, everything would be pretty easy. The nature of karma is at times things are, you know, we're having trouble finding that still center. We're having trouble letting go, finding equanimity and all the rest. But it doesn't mean that the solution isn't the same solution. It just means naturally some things are really hard. If you're in intense pain, you know, it's very hard. I remember talking to somebody who was in very intense pain, and, you know, and it's, he said, you know, it took him years to, you know, he's actually a Buddhist monk, but he said, it took him years to have it where he could just use, where it was mostly a teaching and not just this burden he was carrying. And he says, at times it's still a burden, you know, it's still, he's not always in the place where, you know, at times it overwhelms him and at times it doesn't. And it's hard, you know, and this is the nature of things, you know, just like, you know, having the body being the way it does. And if you think about it, our body's always out of our control. I mean, why would I, you know, I mean, we don't control our pain, our organs, you know, it's like, you know, I remember once I briefly had a bladder problem. I thought, God, I never even think about this. My whole life I've taken it for granted. And suddenly I have a problem, and it's like, what happened here? You know? Now I'm uncomfortable a lot of the time, and it's just one little thing going wrong. It's amazing how much one little thing can make us miserable. You know, you don't think about the 99.9% that's of your body that's fully under control, not causing any discomfort or pain, and you get one thing, and you're miserable. You know, and with training you learn that, okay, you're not, in a way, not to identify with all of that. You know, just like I got an email just last night from somebody who was coming here, who just went to the beach on vacation and says, and suddenly a wave hit her and she tore her ACL, her knee ligament. And now has this, you know, it's like a year, it's this whole big deal to surgery, rehab, you know, the rehabs takes, you know, I think it takes like, you know, a year rehab to, you know, recover from it. And luckily nowadays people do recover from it. But, 40 years ago people didn't recover, you know, you were suddenly you just had a bad, you know, you were going to be in dreadful condition, or, you know, your knee was going to be lousy the rest of your life. But, you know, there you are. This is vacation.